Welcome to the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at cinema's great directors and one of their essential films. This week on the Armchair Directors, we are once again looking at Alfred Hitchcock, this time with his 1948 classic, Rope. Starring James Stewart and Farley Granger, this film tells the story of two college friends who murder their classmate because they feel that he is inferior to them. With me here today to talk about Rope is Professor April Householder. Professor Householder, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So first question we'll start off with is, what is your overall opinion of this film? I've seen this film maybe about four or five times, and this always, for me, ranks as one of Hitchcock's best.
Okay, good. I'm glad you said that because I happen to agree. I think most people know Hitchcock through his better-known works, films like Psycho, Rear Window, Vertigo. And I agree with you that Rope is one of his most underrated. When it came out, it was considered a failure with American audiences, critically and popularly. And then recently, it's been rediscovered by film historians who really take to this film because I think it says something about the era in which it was made in 1940s Hollywood, some of the issues that the film touches on or tries to touch on but doesn't are indicative of that Hays Code era where things couldn't be said, but Hitchcock and all of his brilliance was a master at having all these inside visual jokes and dialogue puns that where he got around the censors and was able to make a film about essentially these two gay murderers in a time where you couldn't even mention the word homosexuality in cinema. So for that reason, I think that film critics are starting to look at this film again, and I think it's really juicy to look at in terms of the layers of stuff that's going on in the film. And also for the technical stuff that he's doing in the film. So imagine an 80-minute long film with no modern CGI, no blood and guts, no music, to speak of, and not even any edits, technically. That is so creepy and so suspenseful. It's a real masterwork in terms of how he pulled that off technically. The cinematography that I just mentioned recently, I think, got reused in the film Birdman, which won the Academy Award last year. And it got a lot of attention for this idea of the uninterrupted long take, which Hitchcock did first in 1948 with this film. And again, without any modern digital technology and using this huge Technicolor camera to do all the in-camera edits. So it was quite a technological feat as well. Yeah, so I think it's a great film.
Yeah, touching back what you were talking about earlier, this film definitely for its time was pretty controversial because I think this was one of the first films to touch on the Leopold and Loeb murders from 1920s.
Yeah. So yeah, that was a case that was a media sensation at the time, the case of Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb, who were two University of Chicago students who decided to murder a 14-year-old boy by the name of Bobby Franks to kind of create the perfect murder. So it was a crime that got a lot of attention because it was so strange and gruesome and because it didn't seemingly have any motivation behind it other than this sort of Nietzschean idea that the boys were toying with as college students, that they were superior somehow intellectually to this boy. And so, yeah, that's the background of the story on which it's based. Of course, then Arthur Lawrence and Hitchcock adapted for the screen and Rope in a little bit different way, but still the seed of that story is there.
And so I know this was originally adapted as a play by Patrick Hamilton, which I remember I actually, when I had a speech and a voice and diction class, I actually used one of the monologues from that play as for one of my assignments. But yeah, so it definitely, this film does feel like a play. It's uninterrupted. It takes place in one setting. It does feel like you're watching a play almost.
Yeah. So this was Hitchcock's first film with Transatlantic Pictures, which was his own production company. And so he had a little bit more freedom to experiment, I think, both technically and with the subject matter that we just talked about, the story of the two gay murderers. It's his first color film and his first collaboration with James Stewart as well. So there were a lot of firsts going on in this film. And I think that Hitchcock was somebody who liked to challenge himself in terms of creating some restrictions and then seeing what would happen. And this film definitely is an experiment in that. Yeah, like you said, the play adapted from Hamilton based on this 1924 case. The screenplay was then adapted by Arthur Lawrence. It feels like a play because it's very much shot to give you that feeling. So it's shot in this one single set, one room basically, with 10-minute takes, which was 10 minutes was the equivalent of one reel of film at the time. Mm-hmm. And so you have this idea that the camera is continuously moving around through the set uninterrupted. And the tracking shots that he uses in a way that conceals where the quote-unquote edits would happen. So the real changes happen to make the invisible camera in-camera editing happen. And it looks like one continuous scene. So it is kind of like sitting for 80 minutes and watching a play. It's interesting because what that does is it makes the running time of the film equal to the dramatic time of the film. And so there's this component that the film and the diegetic material within the film are equal to one another. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing things almost in real time.
Real time, yeah.
Yeah. Again, an amazing accomplishment given that the camera at the time, the Technicolor camera that he was using, weighed thousands of pounds. It had to be meticulously moved around by stagehands and technicians who carefully would kind of choreograph it along with the actors' movements and with their dialogue. And so you have all these scenes where the camera goes through doorways that are being swung open by one actor, and it kind of the camera hesitates and then moves forward. And again, on these huge, literally tracks that were laid throughout the set, again without the idea of having a Steadicam or some digital technology mm-hmm. that would have made that really, really easy. And this technique is great because in the film, what it does is it binds you as a viewer to the film in a very claustrophobic way, so that we're almost stuck in this room with these two characters who have just committed this heinous murder and then decided to have a dinner party around the dead body of the boy. And it becomes very intimate, like a play, because we're stuck in the narrative. We can't get out of it. We're stuck visually in there with him. And that's part of Hitchcock's brilliance, I think. He makes us uncomfortably close to horrible things. That's a theme in many of his films. We become fascinated, but in this film in particular, we literally cannot look away from the stuff that's going on, and so he's sutured us into the film completely, and it's one of these films of Hitchcock's that's been referred to as the limited setting film, and he's done that before in Lifeboat, for example, yep. In Rear Window, it's another example where we are, you know, in Rear Window, for example, where we're stuck with James Stewart with that cast on his leg in the wheelchair, seeing only things in a restricted way from one perspective. So very interesting. The other part of it that's very much like a play is the background of the film, which is an exact miniature replica of 35 miles of the New York skyline. And it's also choreographed so that the passing of real time happens and nightfall is shown, so that little light bulbs light up as time goes by and signs flicker and the action happens in these neon signs that gradually show real time. So that all the technical stuff combined with the fact that it's a dialogue-based film, there's not a lot of action for mm-hmm. something that's so creepy and so much like a suspense or horror film. There's not a lot of movement or action, so all the drama is dialogue-based. There's no reliance on visual effects. There's no reliance on cuts. So if you compare this with, say, the famous shower scene from Psycho, which is all about the editing of that, which makes it so horrific, we don't have any editing here, and so this is one of the restraints of the film. No suspense-building music. So mm-hmm. Hitchcock, also really famous for his collaborations with Bernard Herrmann and how the music in his films creates these peaks and valleys in terms of emotion, and we have none of that here as well. So it's all based on dialogue, the same way that a play would be based. And that's really what makes Lawrence and Hamilton's dialogue so important. It sustains the entire drama without any of the gimmicks of a traditional suspense film.
Mm-hmm. And going back to what you were saying earlier about the cinematography, I mean, you know, nowadays when we talk about the cinematography, and we always like really kind of swoon over the tracking shots, like the True Detective tracking shot in season one, the work of Birdman and the work of Alfonso Cuarón. And, you know, Hitchcock was doing this well before these guys were doing all the tracking shots. So I think this is probably one of the best examples of cinematography in a movie.
Yeah. And if you talk to people that haven't seen this film and have seen some of those other more modern takes on it, there's a, you know, they've lost the narrative of well, somebody did this before mm-hmm. and did it really well and did it with a lot more restrictions on them as a cinematographer. So I think it needs mm-hmm. to be, revisited for that reason.
I was wondering if you heard the story. I guess one of the cameramen that was working on this film, it was the dolling, and it just ran right over his foot and broke it. Wow. And, you know, because Hitchcock didn't want to go do any takes, so before he was about to scream out in pain, Hitchcock cupped his hand over, and they had him gagged and taken out of the studio before he could make a noise. And they still, like, keep going.
Yeah, and that's kind of in line with the way that Hitchcock directed. It was like everything is given up for the shot. You know, he's known as being this sort of, some people have referred to him as a fascist in terms of the way he controlled every aspect of production, from the lenses that he used to the meticulous storyboarding that he did. Every shot was planned out in sequence, and the movements of the camera all plotted out on storyboard, and his interactions with the actors were sort of a little bit people have described it as controlling or masochistic in certain ways, so that doesn't surprise me to hear that story at all.
Yeah, and also touching on when you're earlier about the homosexual subtext in the film, and this is probably one of the first films I think that really dealt with this issue of homosexuality during the Hays Code era, which for back then was extremely controversial.
Yeah, I mean, there is a strong homosexual subtext in the film. Like we said, Leopold and Loeb were gay, so the story is based off of that reality. Granger and Dahl were said to be gay or at least bisexual. Arthur Lawrence, the person who adapted the play, has been very outspoken in the documentary The Celluloid Closet, based on Vito Russo's famous book about LGBT film history, that he was romantically involved with actor Farley Granger, who plays Philip in Rope. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of gay subtext going on within the production and, you know, within the story as well. Even the song that Philip plays on the piano during that scene where Jimmy Stewart is trying to get some information out of him, and he starts playing frantically, you know, faster and faster because he's nervous. The song was composed by a gay composer. So there's so many innuendos here. The housekeeper, for example, mentions that the telephone is located in the bedroom. And the implication there is that there's one bedroom that the boys share together. The fact is, this is a story based on two gay men, and many of Hitchcock's biographers have commented on that. They've commented on Hitchcock's own sexuality and issues he may have had himself in terms of his own repression. And the film is very much about repression, so that claustrophobic environment that we see throughout the film is a reflection of this sort of desire that can't be expressed between the two men, and they end up sort of hating each other for it, I think. They end up hating themselves for it, and then they kind of take it out. It manifests itself through David Kentley's dead body. So they can't express their sexuality with one another, but that gets kind of placed onto this murder. So the murder becomes highly sexualized, right? Mm-hmm. So you remember that early scene in the film after they strangle the boy and put him in the box that they then serve dinner off of to his family and fiance. There's a scene where, you know, Philip asks, "How did it feel, Brandon, when we were committing the murder?" You know, and it's this highly, you know, the dialogue
double
is great. Absolutely. So he says, "I felt exhilarated when his body went limp," you know. So there's all this stuff about replacing their sex act with the murder as something that really is it's a turn on for them in a certain way, right? That it's like this sort of Nietzschean will to power, but it's also a sexualized thing in the film as well. There's another great scene with the champagne bottle standing in for the sort of phallic symbol, where Brandon's fumbling with it, and they're talking about the murder, and then Philip reaches over and grabs it and pops the cork, and so you have this like sort of there's all these innuendos about masturbation and other phallic things going on throughout the film.
You strangled a chicken once, Brandon.
That's right. So and so the other part of the gay triangle here, I think, is Rupert's presence, right? Mm-hmm. So there's this implication that he's been the headmaster at their prep school, an all-boys school, which is a kind of a homosocial environment. And then there's that infamous scene where he talks about witnessing Philip choking a chicken, which, of course, is a euphemism for masturbation, right? So this whole idea that there's an early adolescent sexuality that is shared between the boys and their teacher at this school, I think, implies that there's something that may or may not, we don't know what happened, but there's definitely innuendo.
Yeah, you do feel that they're Brandon and Rupert definitely probably had an affair, because they're even saying, like, you know, he used to be there all night and studying and everything with him, but it's pretty implied what was going on.
Exactly.
Yeah. I did definitely enjoy the performances by Farley Granger and Ronald Dahl. I think they really pulled off the characters well. Like, they played both, like, their personalities well. Dahl was the very powerful, dominant guy, and then Farley Granger's character was very weak and submissive, and I thought they both like played those roles extremely well.
Yeah, I think so too. I think that the dynamic that they have is like a perfect balance of this sort of control and submission, and also Philip's nervousness around what's just happened, and Brandon's trying to kind of keep the lid on that the whole time, and that's what creates the tension. It's like this pot that's about to boil over at any minute, and I love the tension between those two actors in the film. Some critics, Siskel and Ebert, I remember, they have a famous review of this film that they didn't feel like the acting was very strong. But I think that for what the film is trying to do, that it pulls it off really well.
Mm-hmm. And this was James Stewart's very first film with Alfred Hitchcock. And, you know, before he did the films with Alfred Hitchcock, you kind of know him for the more, I guess, lighthearted films, the ones that have the happy endings, like It's a Wonderful Life, this other stuff we did with Frank Capra. So do you feel that starting with this film, you did see him go in a more darker direction, not only with the Hitchcock films, but with stuff like, say, Anatomy of a Murder?
Yeah, I think this is a little bit of a darker role for him, but at the same time, he does provide the sort of savior aspect of the film. So he's still the hero. I mean, he gets in there and he kind of he's the one that flings open the trunk and discovers the body. He kind of solves the case all within, you know, I think his screen time, he's only there half the film. So in 40 minutes, he figures it all out. He opens the trunk. He flings open the windows at the end of the film. He fires the gunshots out and you hear the police sirens coming. So he does end up sort of on the side of the law, on the good guy side, even though, you know, there is all that innuendo about how was he really involved, and how is he responsible for teaching these boys these theories that they took to heart and then committed the murder based off of the things that he was telling them as their teacher. So it is a mixture of dark, but I think he ends up on the side of the good guy in the end.
Yeah, I always say, if you felt morally superior, then why did you leave the guy's hat in the closet?
Yeah.
That's not very smart.
Right.
And so I was wondering, were there any other performances in the film that stuck out to you? Because the other actors in the film, I can't say I'm very familiar with.
Yeah, the two that I really like are the women in this film. So this film is very much about the world of men, right? I mean, Philip and Brandon are these at least bachelor-type guys. They have all the finest things. They have great crystal. They have a great apartment overlooking Manhattan. They drink Veuve Clicquot champagne. I mean, they're sophisticated guys, and it's all about sort of their masculinity. But the two performances of Mrs. Atwater, which is a character played by Constance Collier, and Edith Evanson, who plays the housekeeper, Mrs. Wilson, I really like their portrayals in the film because even though they are these sort of hideous stereotypes of 1940s women in terms of, you know, they're hysterical, they're silly, they're not very smart. You know, Mrs. Atwater keeps going on and on about all these celebrities and movies she's seen, but she can't remember anyone's name, right? But they play those stereotypes to a T, and I think it's quite funny throughout the film. And so there's this aspect of camp humor that, as we go back and look at it many, many years later, I think those are brilliant performances by those two women.
I did like the fact that Hitchcock, when she was talking about the movies, he was giving you a little nudge, nudge, wink, wink. He was like, I love that James Mason, like, North by Northwest. And he's like, what was that movie Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman were in? And it was like, what was it called? And it's just like, wink, wink.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you're talking about earlier, this the film in real time, and you know, when I watched this just a couple days ago, I was surprised, like, this is only 80 minutes, and like, you're watching it, it doesn't feel short. And I'm not saying it drags on or anything, but it sucks you in. You just feel like, wow, it just felt like a lot more time has passed.
Yeah, I mean, I think then that's because you are, like you said, you're locked in from the get-go, from the very first shot where we go enter the apartment through that window, and 80 minutes later, we are stuck in that room with these characters. I think that's part of the appeal. You can't look away from the action, and Hitchcock makes it that way. He makes it so restricted that you can't think about anything else. Your mind can't wander away from the action because you're so busy paying attention to the dialogue and to the visuals and all the little winks and puns that he's laid in there. You just have to stay locked in.
And so I forgot to actually mention this a little bit earlier, but this was Alfred Hitchcock's very first color film. So I was wondering, what did you feel about his use of color, and would you say that you saw his use of color in, like, for his other more classic films in the 50s?
Yeah, so I think the color thing is part of his experiment for the film, that it's a film where he's first working with Technicolor, And even though the color palette of the film is quite muted, I mean, like I said, the apartment is kind of swanky for the times as a reflection of the trends of the time. But the color palette is all full of like pea greens and really pukey yellow curtains in the background. Mm-hmm. The guys wear these really boring navy blue and brown suits. And then when James Stewart comes in, he's got a gray suit. So there's nothing that really sticks out in terms of symbolic uses of color where you think he would have gone for his first Technicolor film. But I think it's significant because really this is a film about two average guys who commit an extraordinary crime. The Leopold Loeb case was considered one of the crimes of the century. And so I think the color palette actually works here because even though there's all these muted colors going on, it's about understatement, right? So they're understated in this really manly way, but also their lives as gay men have to be understated because they're in the closet, so they can't be ostentatious. And the fact that they pull off this murder has to do with the fact that they blended in for so long.
Huh. I did say in the background, I noticed a lot of strange like neon colors and everything in the background going on, especially when it gets dark out.
Yes. So the life that's happening, so he's got a lot of metaphors of life and death in the film, right? And so inside this claustrophobic apartment where we can hardly breathe, and again, that's because strangulation is a theme in the film, right? In the coffin and being submerged in there. But outside is where life happens. So the inside-outside dynamic of life and death, where the blinking lights are happening, and at the end we hear the sounds finally when that window is open and the claustrophobia finally breaks away and we get to breathe take a breath for the first time is interesting. Another metaphor of life and death is actually the table that they serve the dinner off of. So here we have what is essentially a coffin that the boy is locked inside, his dead body, and on top of it it's a cornucopia of food, candlelight, all these life-giving things. So this Hitchcock is got such a dark sense of humor playing with the whole life and death thing there. The skyline is also interesting because it's one of the places where Hitchcock's cameo appears. So there's actually two places for his cameos in this film. One is under the title sequence. He's walking on the street as the titles roll. And the other place is that there's a small red neon blinking sign that's the profile of Hitchcock, the infamous profile. And it's an ad for a product called Reducto, which is a fictitious weight loss supplement. So this is Hitchcock again giving us a wink. And he's also kind of making fun of his own weight and that narrative that ran through popular culture around him.
Yeah, you're definitely talking about the dark humor. I mean, even though this film is a murder story, it's very dark, it has a lot of humor in it. There's all these puns, like when she goes, "I could just strangle you right now." And then "I never strangled a chicken once in my life." And there's just all these, I mean, even though it's dark, it definitely has a lot of funny moments, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that's because of the dialogue had to get around this issue of how are we going to deal with making a film about these two guys who are in a relationship with one another and never mention the term homosexuality or never expose that as part of it? Because the Hays Code did forbid homosexuality and other kinds of things in a long, hideous list of things that could and couldn't be depicted. And so a lot of it had to be in the dialogue to skirt the censors. And lo and behold, they got away with it. I mean, the censors didn't pick up on either. They were too clueless to recognize what was going on, or they didn't look closely enough and pay attention enough. But anyway, it got through.
Yeah. I think it's one thing the Hays Code did. It allowed a lot of people be to as creative as possible, pushing the envelope without actually breaking the envelope, I would say.
Yeah. And that's typical of a lot of artistic movements, that in times where there's a lot of restraint and restriction and censorship, that it's often the times where the art flows. And so, you can look at various periods in art history and film history and see that same thing, the 1920s being in Russia being one of those periods, et cetera.
And so, you're talking about earlier the lack of music in the film. Now, there definitely is no music in the film, but I feel it's interesting at the very beginning when it's introducing the film, it's playing the credits, it has this very romantic score. You think it's going to be this adventure or this love story or something. And then, right when the music stops playing, you hear a guy, and he's getting strangled. So I just love that, how romantic score, and then boom, somebody's getting murdered.
Yes, that primal scream that opens the film is one of the most classic Hitchcock openings, I think, that I've seen.
Mm-hmm. So, you're talking earlier, the mixed reviews. I feel that that's a bit of a common theme for Hitchcock films. I mean, Vertigo was considered, that's considered a classic. Psycho was considered, that's a classic. And now Rope, I mean, Roger Ebert says it doesn't work. Yeah. Stewart said it's the only film he did with Hitchcock that he didn't like, so... Mm-hmm. Why do you feel that it's got that he always gets these mixed reviews when it initially came out?
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, it takes people a while to warm up to the layers and the brilliance that he's got put in there. It's not a surface kind of film. It takes, mm-hmm. you have to pay attention to it and you have to do a little work. It's not sensationalized that way. And so, you know, I think once you see the film 2-3 times or you read the backstory and you really understand what's going on, then you become able to appreciate it a little bit mm-hmm. more. Yeah, I think it's underrated for those reasons.
Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts? I wonder if you've seen any other films that are, there's quite a few films that are based off the Leopold and Loeb case. One film was Compulsion, which came out in like the late 50s, and that starred Orson Welles. Yep. And another film, I saw this for my independent film class, it was called Swoon. Yep. I wonder if you've seen that one too?
Yeah, absolutely. So Swoon, directed by Tom Kalin, is a cornerstone of the new queer cinema movement of the 1990s. And that film helped usher in an era of out directors who weren't afraid to tell stories from a queer perspective. And part of their political project actually was to rescue narratives like this one from the bins of history where the queer themes have been repressed and bring them honestly mm-hmm. to the surface. And so Kalin doesn't mince words about the characters and their relationship. They're obviously gay. They mm-hmm. obviously share a bed. You know, there's a sort of romantic quality to that film in the way that it's shot, in this nostalgic black and white sepia-ish thing with period piece costumes. And it's definitely a retelling of history that's important to LGBT representation. I think that I think they were definitely commenting specifically on the way that Hitchcock treated the subject matter by remaking Swoon to kind of undo some of the hidden history that exists with Rope.
And so do you, when you really think about going back to Hitchcock, do you feel that this film was the start of his golden age? Because like after this, you had Strangers on a Train, Rear Window, Vertigo, all this, Stars Right on the West, all these classics. Do you feel that this film kicked off his classic age?
It could have. I mean, definitely the experimental quality of it. We might say that that's the beginnings of that classic age for Hitchcock. Probably Strangers on a Train for me, 1951, would have been the one that really did it mm-hmm. In terms of you know, his collaborations, in terms of his style really taking hold. But in Rope, all of his main themes are there, if you think about it. So things like voyeurism, guilt and repression as a theme, the idea of confinement, gender issues and sexuality issues that continue all the way, you know, through Psycho with the murderer cross-dressing as his dead mother. The way that Hitchcock aestheticizes horror too in this film, I think, is interesting. And Strangers on a Train was famous for that one fisheye scene where the strangulation happens, the main murder happens, and it's so beautifully rendered. I think there's something about Rope that is also about that theme, that the boys think that this is a work of art. They refer to the murder as a masterpiece. And so Hitchcock really takes pleasure in showing us the dark side of human psyche, and it starts with Rope. I mean, it's in other films or before that too, but I think we could probably bookend 1948 as a good start for the classic period for Hitchcock.
Okay, so now I'm going to put you on the spot here. Uh-oh. Where would you rank this film among Hitchcock's?
Wow. Well, I think it's a quiet little film, but it's a brilliant little film. And it's not, you know, a sweeping production in the way that Vertigo is. The Herman score isn't there. But I think, like I just said, it sets the precedent for a lot of the things that he'll work out later in some of his other more sweeping, epic kind of films that he does with the studio.
Okay. And so last question I have for you is, tell us a little bit about the classes you teach.
So you can find me at HCC in the spring. I teach a course that's fairly new called Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Films, Film 240. I also teach as an adjunct at UMBC, where I teach classes that have to do with race, gender, class, sexuality issues in the cinema. So I teach a class on feminist filmmakers. I teach another class called Race, Gender in the Media. And I teach a class on LGBT cinema called Queer Representations in Film and Television. And I've also taught a course on pornography, although it was a one-time thing, and I haven't taught it in quite a while. But any classes that I teach always revolve around issues of, like I said, race, class, gender, sexuality, and the sociological aspects of cinema.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of the Armchair Directors. We have been talking about Alfred Hitchcock and his 1948 classic, Rope. If you want a tight, suspenseful thriller, you can't go wrong with this film. Don't forget, you can listen to the Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m. and Sunday at 2:30 p.m. You can also listen to the show online at armchairdirectors.podomatic.com. Professor Householder, I want to thank you again for coming on to the show today.
Thank you so much, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's great having you. For the Armchair Directors, I'm Alex Baker saying, did you thank your God, Brandon?